I could read and go through data. I got piles and piles of policies. Guardian's Office policies, which some of you may have never heard of. You might not even believe me. You might think Flynn's making it up. He wrote that policy. When he, five possibilities for obtaining data, blackmail, extortion, all in writing. Thousands of documents like that. Thousands of documents collecting, auditing information, telexing it to the USGO and to England. There's 58,000 documents sitting in Washington, D.C. that have never been released to the public that are basically B1 files of your auditing information. Those are the ones that have never been released. The 20 or 30,000 documents that I've got that have been released, every time I read them, I'm appalled by them. But I'm not going to spend the time I've got trying to go through them all. I mean, some of you may be shocked by it. It may have that type of therapeutic benefit from my point of view on you. Maybe it wouldn't. I don't know. What I'm going to do is tell you a little bit about a little of the cases, some of the current events that are occurring, explain to you the methodology of the cases, the purposes for them, and if I was really the money-grubbing, ambulance-chasing, extortionist, shyster lawyer that I am claimed to be, then why am I spending all my money? And you say, well, you know, who's financing Flynn? That's the favorite question. Where is my money coming from? Well, I've begged and I've borrowed and I've spent all my own resources to litigate against this organization because, as people like Eddie Walters know, everyone that comes to me has no money. The organization has already cleaned them out. And I'll run through my clients, and there is not a client who has given me any money to date, with the exception of one. And it's a small amount, very small. But the Tanya Burdens and Lavenda Van Schaik's and Janet Troy's and Marjorie Hansen's, they've got no money. They're like probably a lot of you if you came to me. They've never given me anything. I financed the whole thing myself. Why? I ask myself that every day now. When I started, it was because of this, and I don't like bullies. And I didn't think that this organization should bully Lavenda Van Schaik. As it went on, and they began to try to destroy me, as I said, I got more energetic. I mean, it's that simple of psychological truth. The more I saw what I perceived to be oppression, and the more people who contacted me, and there's been in excess of 2,000 to date, and the more I heard the horror stories, and horror stories of beyond description, but I don't want to spend all my time up here telling horror stories. I mean, involving all kinds of things. Quentin Hubbard to Susan Meister's family, to Marjorie Hansen, to Janet Troy. Incredible horror stories. Some outrageous ones. You know, a simple little one like finding Janet Troy's button. One of my clients that came to me in early 1980, going through her, culling her files. How do I know they culled her files? Warren Frisky, the head of B2 in Boston, is now my client. He did it. He gave me an affidavit saying he did it. He and 15 other people in the Guardian's office. I mean, I've got those affidavits. If we can produce all these people's affidavits. I've got other Guardian's office, Carol Garrity, Janie Peterson, Eddie Walters. Loads of people now have come to me and told me, yeah, they did it. They called files. They were ordered to do so by the GO. But in Janet's case, they knew that her father was very religious man, and he was a Catholic and opposed to abortion, and her auditor got her pregnant, and she was only in for about 8 months, but her auditor got her pregnant, and which is really not even what the truth's about, but that's the, but so that, you know, some smart, well, Warren did it, Warren Frisky did it, called through the file, found her button with her father. And her father was opposed to abortion. Well, when she got pregnant, she had to go have an abortion. What do you think one of the first things the guardian's office did in Janet's case? I mean, if you were going to try to bend the mind of Janet Troy so she wouldn't talk to Flynn, so she wouldn't pursue her remedies against the church, what would you do to try to assault her character, assault her person? You'd push the button. Well, they did that, and they did it to just about every other client, too. They called Marjorie Hansen's mother into a deposition, and they said, did you know your daughter had oral sex with her auditor? Which they took right out of her folder. I mean, look, we could go on forever with horror stories, and I'm not sure how far it will get us. The point is that those people have been contacting me. They have no money. I took their cases because I was outraged. I didn't think that it was appropriate for this organization to be doing those things, so I sued them. And all hell broke loose. Well, it broke loose before I even sued them. I mean, they had 30 people working on me before the first suit was ever brought, within 60 days before the first suit was ever brought. They took my whole history apart. And a threat called me on the phone and said, you know, whatever I've ever done is going to be on the front page of the Boston Globe. I said, go ahead. Do it. And as I uncovered documents, blackmail of reporters who had tried to investigate the church, say one, his first name is Ron, in 1975, and they found out that he had taken marijuana to Japan and that he had a girlfriend while he was married. So they blackmailed him, and he dropped the whole investigation. As I uncovered more and more documents like that and pursued it more and more, I became more committed as a person to doing something that I perceived to be inappropriate, without regard to sex, race, or national origin, inappropriate, and specifically without regard to religion. Most Scientologists would be very surprised to hear my own philosophical and personal views toward my life, the people around me, and organized and disorganized religion. Most of you would be very surprised. And it's a private matter. It's something that I don't normally talk about. Suffice it to say that I believe in the power of the Spirit, and I believe that the power of the Spirit includes within it the power to be truthful, to tell the truth, and to let your spirit flow so that truth naturally comes out. There's a person sitting in the audience who is been PR'd as a clerk for Mr. Hubbard. His name is Jerry Armstrong. And if you believe the PR line, he was just a clerk, a low-level clerk. Well, maybe Jerry is. Jerry's maybe a clerk. I don't know. But I do know one thing. He was assigned by L. Ron Hubbard to collect data and documents on L. Ron Hubbard to prepare a biography by Omar Garrison. And Jerry did it. Just as he had diligently worked in the Sea Org from 1969 or whatever, together with his wife Jocelyn, his former wife Terry Gamboa, he diligently collected the documents. Probably too diligently. Because he collected documents that were supposed to have been destroyed by one version of the story. The documents were supposed to have been, and most of them were in the handwriting of Mr. Hubbard. Now, I'm not here to vilify Mr. Hubbard. Mr. Hubbard's credentials, or lack of credentials, or purposes, or goals, that I perceive in a lot of these writings in the 1940s when he embarked on this crusade, may be different. Mine may be different than your perceptions, and each person would probably have to read these documents to draw their own perception. Suffice it to say, he is definitely not a nuclear physicist. He definitely did not go to Princeton, nor did he graduate from George Washington University, nor is he a war hero, nor did he serve 4 years in combat, nor was he twice pronounced medically dead. None of those things are true. Now, you know, some people say, well, you know, suppose Thomas Edison was a pervert, he still invented the light bulb. And Elrond Hubbard invented the text. Well, I happen to have a philosophical disagreement there, too. I don't think Elrond Hubbard just invented the tech. I think all of you people invented the tech. I think every day your spirit flows, you invent the tech. But I think what he did do is he wrote some of it down. Some of it he took from a variety of sources. And I think a lot of these documents that Jerry has show where he took it from. Maybe in some cases took it very literally from. But there is one salient fact that comes from all of that, and that is there have been misrepresentations. I mean, I've got Dianetics, the original thesis, sitting in my office that says he graduated from Columbian College, which is part of George Washington University. That's an untrue statement. If the organization is supposed to confront and deliver truth, and deliver theta, then why did they put in Dianetics, the original thesis that he read? You know, maybe it's an editorial slip-up, you might say. You know, why did they put in that he served 4 years in combat and was the most decorated war hero of World War II when he was relieved of duty on 3 or 4 different occasions, eventually found a gasoline bomb in the USS Algol shortly before sailed into combat and was relieved of duty, and right after that ended up in the Oak Knoll Military Hospital as a psychiatric inpatient. Well, Ron is like every other human being. He's like me, he's like you, he's got his good and his bad. Maybe he told a few untruths, maybe he told some big ones, maybe he told a lot of truths. The fact remains that people relied on things that were said. There were some kids who did believe he was a nuclear physicist, that it was more exact than axiomatics and chemistry and physics and was based on 30 years of research. People rely on things you say. There's a degree of responsibility in having your spirit flow and tell the truth, because other spirits rely on it. So those things were not true. And I take exception that, and that's one of the things I take exception to in my lawsuits. There are other things that have been misrepresented. The original article or device case, the FDA case, the right to use your emologically, and my clients, are half of them are still auditing Scientologists. Eddie Walters still audits. The FDA case was not a case that was designed to prevent you people from using the e-meter. It was a case by the Food and Drug Administration to prevent the organization from making representations which were inaccurate. Anyone can use an e-meter, and the federal government would never take your right away to use an e-meter. And it is simply legally preposterous to think Valerie Stanfield's right to audit Debbie Hayden. It's just ridiculous. It doesn't even warrant further discussion, but a lot of my clients come in and say, well, the federal government was, you know, going to deprive us of the right to a practice religion and our right to use the e-meter. I mean, Believe me when I tell you, their case is it's just utter nonsense. The case had to do with misrepresentations that were made to people. The federal government is a big bureaucratic organization. They can't, as a lot of you may not now know, now that you're on the other end, now you're maybe on my side, and you want to see that justice is done, and you are speaking out, and you're now being attacked. And you go down to the local district attorney or attorney general, they could care less. They've got bigger problems. They've got rapes and crimes and larcenies, et cetera. It's Mary Sue Hubbard. It took 1,000 GO agents and 150 burglaries and Operation Snow White and an army of kids coding and decoding telexes by the Owl Code and the Eagle Code, et cetera, in the framing of Paulette Cooper. It took an army of incidents and outrageous facts to get the FBI interested. I mean, the idea that this big monolithic FBI and this big bad government and this big bad Flynn are out to destroy the church, believe me when I tell you, it's simply ridiculous. It's preposterous. You can't get a state or federal agency off its ass. To get anything done. So the question arises, and the reason I bring that up, is the question arises, well, why did they get involved? The reason is because people like yourself began to complain in the early 50s, as Ron DeWolf, L. Ron Hubbard Jr. would tell you. Now, some of you may not like Ron DeWolf, some of that you may think he doesn't tell the truth. You may think a lot of things, but the fact of the matter is he was there from 50 to 59, along with a lot of my other clients now who were there also. And there were people who complained. There were people who paid a lot of money to have whatever fixed, cured, whatever. And they didn't get what was promised them. The representations did not turn out to be accurate. And they went and they complained. And finally, enough of them began to complain, and there were enough problems, so the government began to look into it. That's the simple reality of what occurred. The idea that this big monolithic battle is being fought between the government and freedom of religion does you people a severe disservice and deprives you of your right. It deprives you of your right to practice religion, to practice Scientology. It establishes and allows an organization, a collective, to establish through the power that they now hold the right to prevent you from objecting. And that is what has got to be dealt with today. So Jerry Armstrong has a lot of documents, and the church has an army of lawyers that are trying to prevent these documents from being released. Now, the documents, to my mind, are earth-shattering. I mean, they are. I've read a lot of them, and a lot of them are in Mr. Hubbard's handwriting. And I'm not going to stand up here and tell you what they say, because then you'll think I'm just trying to vilify Ron. Believe you when I say that some of them are flabbergasted. Things he did, things he said, views he espoused, reasons he took for writing Dianetics and when he was founding this organization. What they did for Jerry is they, quote, deprogrammed him. They told him the truth. He confronted various facts when he read these documents. So he left. And then the organization began an unholy campaign against him, so he came to me. So now the organization has got an army of lawyers distributed, trying to prevent the documents from being, so that people would see the truth, so the truth would be confronted. And as myself and little Julia Dragojevic, this young female lawyer in Bruce Bunch's office, who have been defending him, with virtually no money, against an army of lawyers. And what are we trying to do? We're trying to get the documents released. What are they trying to do? They're trying to get the documents suppressed. So, unfortunately, one of the keys to the whole thing is Omar Garrison. Well, fortunately or unfortunately, Omar is a very nice man, and I know him, and he was my client. And he's in a very difficult situation. He contracted with a Guardian's office front group to write the biography of L. Ron Hubbard based on, in part, these documents. And now the book won't, you'll never read the book. What's going to happen, I'm not sure, but you'll never read the book. And you'll never see the documents, because if somehow Omar is taken out of the picture, if somehow his differences with the Guardian's office and David Miscavige and Norman Starkey are resolved, and Sherman Linsky are resolved, then you won't ever see these documents and you won't ever see Omar's book. And to me, that'll be a tragedy, because I think the documents would have opened a lot of eyes. And the likelihood, as I stand here, is that all of the legal maneuvering that is being done, even though we've won the first two rounds of Jerry's case and the documents are still in the court, even though they've done everything, they filed declarations of Mary Sue Hubbard to try to get them released to the organization, the court still has them, thank goodness. But shortly, if a certain avenue that the current leadership has taken works out, which I think it's going to, you will never see those documents, and you will never ever read Omar Garrison's book. Someday, some of the things in the documents are going to come out, and I hope they do, and I hope that each one of you who has known L. Ron Hubbard, his writings, have the opportunity to read these very closely. There are going to be some very shocked people. You're going to come to realize the fundamental truth. There's the PR line to get money and information, sell courses and books. There's the ultimate schizophrenia that's been created in this organization. There's the PR line which grabs on the good intentions of all of you people. And then there's the truth, the way things really are, the way they are in an auditing session. The aberrations, the problems, the good, the bad, the ugly. It's all there. But the key is, it's not all this positive 100% PR nonsense that's misrepresented to you. The full truth for your viewing is there if you ever get to see it. Tonya Burden. You've probably all heard stories about Tonya Burden. Some of you may know Kima Douglas, former CEO of the CMO, former personal aide to L. Ron Hubbard, his personal medical officer, who used to get blank prescriptions that thick, signed in blank by Dr. Dink, Ron's physician, to get medications for Ron. Well, Kima is now not talking, but when I first met Kima about a year ago in a hotel room here in Los Angeles, she said to me, well, you know, I've heard so much about you, and I just know that you're not legitimate, because I know that Tonya Burden never had sex with Ron. And you put it in your complaint, and you've been saying that all over the country. I said, who told you that, Kima? She said, well, that came up line. I saw the telexes, I saw it all in there. I said, did you ever see any document that I ever wrote or hear one word that I ever uttered to that effect? Because that has never been said. I said, what the complaint says is that at the age of 15, among a lot of other things, she was coding and decoding telexes for Operation Snow White while she should have been in school. She was following Ron around collecting his ashes. She was zipping his fly up and down every day, putting his pants on and off. That's what the complaint says. And those are what the facts are, and we will stand behind it. It's that little germ of misinformation that was in Kima's mind. It's that level of distortion that I'm trying to fight. Let the chips fall where they may. If Jerry Armstrong has said to Thornton, or Tanya Burden, or Lavinda Van Schaik, let them come out. Put them on the witness stand. Just let it all come out. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to get a trial. I'm trying to get trials and just let it come out. This army of lawyers that we're fighting against is interposing every legal maneuver known to man in modern jurisprudence to prevent these trials and prevent an unfettered disclosure of the truth. The missing persons case, I'll just touch briefly on. Why did I file the missing persons case through Ron DeWolf? The reason I filed it is because Ron's lawyer, Alan Goldfarb from Miami, in Tanya Burden's case, filed an affidavit. And in his affidavit, he said four things. He said, I've never met L. Ron Hubbard, even though I'm representing a million-dollar case. I have no means to communicate. I know of no one in the Church of Scientology of California who has communicated with L. Ron Hubbard since February 1980. He filed that affidavit in May 1982. So the third thing was, I know of no person who has communicated with L. Ron Hubbard in the Church of Scientology of California since February 1980. Ron's own lawyer under oath, under the pains and penalties of perjury, and I've got the affidavit here. The fourth thing he said, I know of no person who has communicated with L. Ron Hubbard since February 1980. Ron's own lawyer making those four statements. Well, at the time he was in communication with Sherman Linsky, Stephen Linsky, who were in regular communication with David Miscavige, Lyman Spurlock, Norman Starkey, who have been telling you people through the hidden data line that they're in regular communication with Ron and that David Miscavige's origin of authority flows from Ron's daily battle plan to him. While his lawyer, who's defending him, is saying those things under oath in May 1982. Well, curiously enough, at the same time in May 1982, Office Services, Inc., Religious Technology Center, et al., is taking over all of the church. Curiously enough, in May 1982, or shortly thereafter, June 7th, to be exact, an individual walks into a bank in New York City with a $2 million check drawn on L. Ron Hubbard's account, supposedly forged, made payable to an Aquil Abdul Emia. Now, the church, this information I've just given you, I acquired before the missing persons case. The church will come forward and claim that I have just told you something that is under seal. Well, the information came before the case, before the information was ever sealed. So if anyone tells you Flynn gave you sealed information, one of the reasons I brought the case, because I put it in the complaint when the legal proceedings first started, was that someone had tried to pass a $2 million check on L. Ron Hubbard's account. At the same time, Religious Technology Center has ended up with complete control of the church, Office Services, running all of Hubbard's assets. His lawyer filing an affidavit saying no one can communicate with him. It's that degree of untruth that's permeated Mr. Hubbard's life in this litigation and created the schizophrenia in the organization that I'm litigating against. I brought the missing persons case, regardless of what you read in the media, or from Tom, Dick, or Harry, because his own lawyer said he was missing. His own lawyer said that he couldn't communicate with him, didn't know his whereabouts, knew of no one who could communicate with him, couldn't defend the case. And I've got the affidavit here for anyone who wants to see it. Mr. Hubbard was also defaulted for failure to appear and defend the Paulette Cooper case, where they broke into Paulette Cooper's apartment, or broke into Paulette Cooper's psychiatrist's office and stole her psychiatric records and then used it as part of Operation Freakout against her. Now, again, to show you the level at which the Guardian's office operates, Paulette Cooper's parents were killed in Auschwitz. In this country, she was adopted by Jewish parents. And while she was at Brandeis in journalism, she went to a psychiatrist, Dr. Stanley Katz. The reason she went to a psychiatrist is because she had a lot of conflict between her feelings towards her parents killed in the Holocaust and her real parents. And as she was growing as a young woman, she began to experience a lot of things that she wanted to talk to someone about. So she went to this Dr. Katz. Well, she told Dr. Katz what I just told you, and that she loved her adopted parents, but that she had this conflict. Well, Robert Dardenau, one of my clients now, and two other people, broke into Katz's office pursuant to Project OWL as part of Operation Freakout, and stole Katz's records and then mailed the notes to her parents. The button survey and the operations definition section of the AG Minihan. Well, that type of thing is the type of thing that the cases are about. And it's the type of thing that caused me to fight as strongly as I have, notwithstanding everything they've done to me. The missing persons case was designed for precisely the purposes for which it was legally intended, to determine whether he was missing. Where is he? And his son brought it forward because, regardless of what you may have heard about Nib, regardless of the problems he may have had in the past, maybe Nibs has done some confronting. Maybe Nibs has tried to come to grips with his father's history, and things that he's been involved in, and now wants to do what he can to have the truth come out. And maybe that's why he was willing to, according to the PR line of the church, attack his father. Maybe he wanted to know whether his father was really missing. Well, his father, presumably, and my handwriting expert says, maybe yes, maybe no, but I hired an honest handwriting expert. I didn't hire a handwriting expert to say this is a fake signature and we'll get a win. I gave him the declaration that Ron filed in that case, and I said, just tell me whether it's legitimate or not. For better or worse, I want to know. He had come back with other documents, the assignment of the trademark, the Religious Technology Center. He had come back with those and said those were fakes. Those were not signed by Ron Hubbard. He came back on this one, he said, I don't know. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. It's too close. So that's what we told the court. We told them we didn't know. But what we did know is that whenever L. Ron Hubbard signed on a line, where a line was provided for his signature, he signed right on the line. And this signature is off in no relationship to the line, which suggested to us, as we argued, that maybe he signed a blank piece of paper and the name was later typed in. We don't know. The mystery has now been created. Just as the mystery of the Armstrong documents has been created by the church and Mr. Hubbard, the mystery continues. We tried to find out. We don't currently know. We don't know whether he's totally incapacitated, whether he's dead, whether he's alive. I've got my hunches and my feelings, but we really don't know. Someone filed a declaration. From everything I've read that Ron has written, and his particular care about things he says about people, I don't believe that he wrote that declaration. That's my own personal belief. I don't personally believe he wrote it. I believe he signed it. Someone told him to sign it. And given his current health history, which we've got pretty much documented, he suffers from duodenal ulcers, chronic viral pneumonia. He's had three pulmonary embolisms, one of which almost killed him, bursitis, arthritis, a whole host of ailments. Now, I don't tell you that because I'm trying to, again, vilify Ron Hubbard and paint him something different than what you thought he was. But the fact of the matter, he's not what has been represented about his health history. The fact of the matter is that those ailments in an elderly, ill person could cause that person to be very easily manipulated, very easily told untruths, half-truths. And Tonya Burden worked with David Miscavige for years. And a lot of my clients who worked with David saw the way he reacted with L. Ron Hubbard, as some of you may know. And they know the level of manipulation, the level of half-truths, and the level of lies that go on at the top. So, it's currently a mystery. As far as we're concerned legally, in a way, it served our purpose. We didn't get a trustee appointed to represent Hubbard's interests. But we got a declaration from him saying that Office Services, Inc. is representing his interests, even though at the same time that they take control, someone tries to pass a $2 million check. And the next thing you know, they'll say that my client, or Flynn, forged L. Ron Hubbard's $2 million check. The level of misinformation that the organization is potentially able to distribute is awesome. And I suggest to you that you should look at everything they say with a very fine tooth comb and try to find out for yourself. The other thing that caused us to file the suit was that there was a whole series of financial transactions that took place that are highly suspect in our minds as to who was calling the shots. And there was a purge of a lot of high-level people who we thought were very close to Hubbard, who we thought that Hubbard would never forsake, if you want. And for some reason, a lot of those people got purged. That made us wonder also what happened to Ron Hubbard. The current management of the church, which I'll just touch briefly on, as you know, is Starkey and Miscavige and Gamboa, Reynolds and Spurlock, etc. I ask you, by what authority are they the leaders of the church? Why isn't there a democratic or some type of a voting arrangement where the people who contribute the money, the work? I mean, Jerry Armstrong worked 18 hours a day, 7 days a week for 12 years. Why shouldn't he have a voice? Why shouldn't all the people who worked for all these years and paid all the money, the people with the good intentions, the people who understand the ultimate reality of self-confrontation and auditing, the people who use that in their daily lives and intend to do good things with the tech, why shouldn't they be the people in control of the bank accounts making the decisions rather than a 22-year-old who supports himself on the hidden data line, which is a total mystery to everyone, when supposedly everyone is supposed to be confronting and the truth is supposed to be flowing out? It shouldn't be tolerated. It creates oppression. It creates Adolf Hitler's. It creates SS mentality. That type of mystery oppresses you people. And it's got to be swept away. Let the chips come out. And we'll see who's telling the truth. Just briefly on some of the current governmental cases, there's an investigation going on in Toronto. There's a lot of reasons there's an investigation going on in Toronto. One of the reasons is one of the tape recordings that Jerry Armstrong had possession of that some of you people should listen to, where Charles Parcell, some of you may know who he is, former highest legal officer of the church, Laurel Sullivan, some of you may know who she is, a lot of former high-ranking church members had a meeting, and they were trying to figure out what to do with the IRS, because the IRS is after them. Well, why should the IRS be after this innocent church? Well, on the tape recording, the following appears. So, we've been holding out to the public and to the government and to everyone else for years that Ron resigned in 1966 and that we're all separate corporate entities and Hubbard's got no control of the church and nothing to do with it. When the fact of the matter is, this is on the tape, this is Charles Parcell speaking on the tape recording in a high-level meeting of all the top leaders. Everyone knows that the reality and the truth is he's controlled everything. LRH has controlled everything. And there's no corporate integrity, quote unquote, that's a quote, no corporate integrity. All the boards of directors and officers resign in advance and he holds the resignation. And the $2.1 million payment by RRF, Religious Research Foundation, to Hubbard is a classic case of fraud, quote unquote. That's on the tape recording. Well, if you were a government and you saw that, what would you do? You know, some Scientologist from France comes to Flag and pays $50,000 for the OT levels or whatever and makes his check out to RRF and it ends in Ron's pocket, when in fact Ron supposedly resigned in 66 and is not getting any money from the church, which is just another misrepresentation. What do you expect the government to do? I mean, you pay your taxes to look into things like that. So Toronto, for a lot of different reasons, including assassination plots, burglaries, for a lot of different reasons, is investigating the church. Clearwater is doing the same thing for a host of different reasons, because they tried to destroy the mayor of Clearwater, because an organization came into his town under United Churches of Florida, and he said, you know, what's United Churches of Florida? And they had this elaborate cover through Operation Goldmine, in Operation Normandy, and when he began to ask questions, they had Operation Keeler 1, Operation Keeler 2, Operation Speedy Gonzales, four or five other operations to destroy Mayor Cazares. You know, what do you expect the government to do? The criminal cases of the same type. The fact of the matter is the GO did it. They've been doing it for years. They did it per policy, right from LRH down. In fact, Mary Sue Hubbard signed a document, a 286-page document entitled Stipulation of Evidence, stipulating that LRH was, quote, the overall supervisor, unquote, of the Guardian's office while all of this was going on. The 11 people that went to prison were all the top people, Jane Kimber, Henning Held. They ran the church. I mean, for them to come forward and say a few criminals did it in the PR approach that they take in order to preserve the religion of Scientology, which is the reason they say they're doing it, spreading that lie. If Scientology is in its nature to tell the truth, how do you spread lies and disseminate Scientology? Just breathe.